Sometimes I wish there was someone in charge with all of Al-Anon. One of our speakers said he was hunting rules. Yeah, I understand that. My name is Blanche, and I am a member of a worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon High. I have been in reluctant recovery since July 7th, 1964, but I have been addicted to mood-changing, mind-altering men ever since I can remember. Which is why there is a fellowship called Al-Anon. I spent my 35th Al-Anon birthday flying to you. And I thought as I battled the weather and canceled flights and so forth, how better could I have spent it, you know? That's what it was about. 35 years makes me a survivor, not a savior. And I try to remember that on a daily basis. At all times, I am one person away from an obsession. I, of course, would be remiss in my good manners if I did not thank the committee for the invitation to this beautiful place and the snacks in my room, but mostly the warm hospitality and your smiles of welcome. I was in New Mexico a few years ago, and they were selling buttons. This was an AA convention, and it said, a good convention is like an orgy. When it's over, you don't know who made you feel good. I, of course, have no idea what that means, but it, usually people laugh, so I'll give it to you for what it's worth. I have been trying for years now. It's not the way I started out when I began to be invited to share my program, but I have been trying now for at least 20 years to be as open and as vulnerable as I know how to be when I'm up here. See, it would be easier for me to tell you what I think than how I feel. It would be easier for me to lecture about the program and its principles, but you want me to share and not lecture. And you told me early on that that which does not come from the heart does not reach the heart. I want to reach your hearts this morning. You also taught me it was all right to ask for what I need, and I need you loving me back. Sitting there, you are taking no risks at all. And anyone standing on a podium and talking into a mic is risking being misunderstood, being rejected, and oh my, being misquoted. And so I need to feel you loving me back while I talk. So many of you have told me that you've heard me here or there, or you've heard tapes. Try not to mouth it along with me as I go. It distracts me when you do that. But I came here to participate in your convention and not to perform. I can't talk without using a few notes. I am so envious of these people who can remember everything they want to say just off the top of their heads. I told the people at the Al-Anon meeting yesterday that it won't be long until I can hide my own Easter eggs. My memory is not what it used to be. Of course I believe that God can tell me what to say. But he isn't limited to doing that the minute I step onto the podium. I've known for a year and a half that I was coming, and it would be insulting to you if I told you I had no idea what I'm going to say. I do have an idea of what I hope I'm going to say anyway. I think it's hard to vary one's story. If you do it twice a month, you're in and you're out, you're in and you're out. I don't know how you tell a different story every time. I only have one, and I'm not going to go out and do it over again, so I'll have something different to tell you. And I know this sounds pious, and I am not, but I would rather you leave here thinking what a marvelous program than what a marvelous speaker. I came into Al-Anon kicking, screaming, clutching my halo, wrapping my robes of righteousness about me, heels dug in, and protesting to everyone who would listen and a lot of people who didn't care that I was fine, thank you. I hadn't done any drinking, so I didn't need any therapy, and if we just had sobriety at our house, we wouldn't have any problems. I can't say that with a straight face anymore, but I am so grateful that God led me to a group of people who were serious about recovery. What I know of Al-Anon principles today, I know not because someone read them to me or recited them to me, but because these principles were practiced lovingly and tenderly on me. They loved me when I was unlovable. They forgave me when my behavior was condescending and patronizing, and God forgive me, and He has. Although He does send me newcomers like that all the time. I think He's just getting even. And I began to hear what Al-Anon was not before I heard what it is. I learned that it is not a ladies' auxiliary. It's not a stitch and bitch club. It's not a coffee clutch. These people were serious about getting well. And I'm going to say this, although it may not be a problem in Florida, it is in Texas. There are well-meaning members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they just haven't thought about it, who will refer to any non-alcoholic as an Al-Anon in their family, you know. That would be like having me refer to a still-drinking alcoholic as a member of AA. An Al-Anon is a member of an Al-Anon family group. She attends regularly, studies the literature, has a sponsor, works the steps, does some sponsoring, you know. So when you hear someone who isn't in an Al-Anon group talking about Al-Anon, don't listen. Those people are uninformed. They are not carrying the message. They are spreading the disease. Well, anyway, back to what we are not. We're not cookie bakers and coffee makers. And above all, we are not AA groupies, most of us. Right. Now, Al-Anon has never claimed to be a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism, and it doesn't propose to save marriages, only sanity. I thought both of those were in good shape when I got to you, but I live to learn better than that. Happily ever after may not mean walking hand in hand into the sunset together. Happily ever after means my personal recovery. The program is for me, and so I have a success story to share with you. It didn't depend on external circumstances, but what was going on inside me. And I will echo what Anne said. Al-Anon is not the enemy. We are the ones who loved you when you were just a little bit hard to love sometimes. And I can't see why doing that would make us the enemy. It just doesn't. We are the first to admit that we are the sick ones too. And I've had that pointed out to me, if I hadn't noticed it, more than once. The analogy I always use when I start my talk is my mother's illness and death. I know it isn't fashionable to love your family, so sue me. I adored this woman. I have two brothers, one of whom I will see tomorrow, that I absolutely love. I have since they were little, darling little boys toddling around the house. I didn't know it wasn't okay, you know. My mother was 58. That isn't young, but it's too young to die. And I thought I couldn't stand it. She was in Florida. I was in Texas. I managed to get to Florida to see her four times the last 6 months of her life. And on my last visit, I knew it would be the last one. I knew the next call to Texas would be to tell me that she was gone. I stepped out into the hall of her hospital room because I was crying so hard, and a woman I've never seen before or since in a room across the hall beckoned me. I went into her room and she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." And I said, "You don't understand. Her illness is terminal." She said, "I didn't say she's going to get well. I said she's going to be all right." And my mother did not get well, and she has been all right ever since. Now, I tell you that because when I got to you, it's as if, now no one said this, but it's as if you said to me, "You're going to be all right." And if you had, I would have said, "Oh, you don't understand. I have a barely sober husband." And you would have said, "We didn't promise you a husband. We said, you're going to be all right." Or I would have said, "I have a very fragile, shaky marriage." And you would have said, "We didn't promise you a marriage. We said, you're going to be all right." Because, you know, somehow that's what I heard. And I have been all right. I believe everything you've ever told me. That part was certainly true, too. When I was a little girl, I'll tell you in a minute that my family's been in Florida for seven generations. I'm the only one that ever left. We were living in Jacksonville until I was 10, and it was even then a big city. And when fire engines or ambulances were roaring down the street and I heard the siren, I was scared. And my mother said, "Oh, honey, don't be afraid. That means help is on the way." And I never hear one now, but I think that. And then she said, and you need to pray for the person who needs it. If we had a siren for Al-Anon, I would be sounding it all the time, because I so much want to say to people who don't know that there's a better way to live, I want to say, help is on the way. And if I could, I would. So you give me a little chance to do that this morning. Leave, what happened? Can you hear me? Well, I couldn't hear me for a minute there. One time in Massachusetts, and I was talking, and I said, because they had a faulty system, I said, "Can you hear me?" And someone in the back yelled, "Yes, but we can't understand you." I'm assuming you can both hear and understand me, all right? Our literature tells us how to make an Al-Anon talk. I haven't memorized it yet. Some year I will do that. But it says, and I quote, "Al-Anon talks can be, and too often are, merely a repetition of past and present sorrows. Sketching the background is important and has its place, but it is merely the foundation of the whole talk. The best Al-Anon talk, the one that helps the most people to the highest degree, is the one that brings out just how the program works and just how the speaker follows it. A good Al-Anon talk may be divided into three parts: how sick I was, how well I am, what helped me to get well. Of these three, the emphasis should be on what helped me to get well. I hope I spend the majority of the minutes I have with you this morning sharing with you what has helped me to get as well as I am. I agree with Father Martin, too, who says that when he's sitting out there and you're up here, he says, you're playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you were without telling me how well you are. To say that I've enjoyed the speakers this weekend is such an understatement. It just blew me away. And they talked about recovery. And I can't identify with their drinking years, but wow, I can identify with our using this program. I think I've told all of them thank you, but if I missed anybody, thank you, thank you. Well, I was born on my grandmother's farm in northeast Florida up by Live Oak. On Christmas Day, I no longer say the year of our Lord, which one. I've reached the point where I not only lie about my age, but I forget what I've said that it was, and so I just don't tell it. I'm somewhere between Blue Lagoon and on Golden Pond, all right? I've already told you that we were not tourists. Tourist was a bad word. Anytime I behaved in a manner my mother considered inappropriate, she would say, "Don't act like a tourist." When I told you I was the only one who had left, I had a brother whose company sent him to other places sometimes, but he has retired now, and so I'm still the delinquent one. When I go to family reunions, they say, "Why don't you come on home now?" And I've been in Texas since I was 17, and I loved it from the day I set foot there. But you know, I miss the blue water and the white sand, and I have to get back home every year or two. I'll be here with you now, and I'll be back to Fort Walton Beach in January, and that's really home, because I told you I lived in Jacksonville until I was 10, and then in Pensacola until I married, and I think of that as my hometown because we lived there the longest, and because that's the place I went back to all those years. You know, you bring the children back to see their grandparents. It was at that time a wonderful place to grow up. It was a beautiful, quiet little city on that beautiful blue water. You can't tell I miss it, can you? I have a container of Pensacola Beach sand on my kitchen windowsill, and people say, "Why do you keep sugar on your windowsill?" That's just, I grew up thinking all beaches looked like that. I mean, those are the only ones you've ever seen. And I know there are all kinds of beautiful beaches, but I'm sorry, the others look dirty to me. Anyway, I mentioned that we lived in Jacksonville. My father was charming, intelligent, talented, sensitive, is there any other kind, alcoholic. Unfortunately, he was also violent. I was never, thank God, sexually abused, but I was a very badly battered child. Let me say this carefully. I knew this man loved me with all his heart, and I loved him. And if some well-meaning social worker had swooped in and taken me out of that home, I would have been devastated. I just knew that every now and then he went crazy, and the remorse just ate him alive. Of course it would. We were living in grinding and abject poverty. I was a child of the Depression. I don't mean no luxuries. I mean there was not enough food for days on end. There was inadequate clothing, and we lived in a very blighted area of the city. The shelter wasn't sumptuous either. I try always to say to you, poverty has nothing to recommend it. It does not ennoble the human character. It's a debasing and a degrading way to live. And I hope you will fight it every way you know how. With education, with your checkbook, with your ballot, any way that you can. It's not the fault of the children. Because the things were so bad at my house, the neighborhood children were not allowed to play with me. Now, I understand today how their parents must have felt, you know, a little apprehensive. But I didn't understand it then. And when you're 4 and 5 and 6 years old, I just felt rejection and rage. We all went to the same neighborhood school, and when we started school, I beat the socks off every one of them. Vince, I too test well, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it. It was my way up and out. My motivation wasn't good, but there was a happy byproduct. I fell in love with learning, and I've never fallen out of love with it. The most exciting thing that can happen is a new idea, and the older we get, the fewer of them we encounter. I'm grateful because my most constant joy, the one that hasn't forsaken me or changed, is that of learning. I've tried to keep the battering from my mother. I was a candidate for Al-Anon even then. I was protecting the alcoholic. But eventually, I was 8, and I could no longer hide the blood and the bruises. And she was horrified. She divorced my father and remarried a couple of years later a man that, as it happened, didn't drink at all. We were not close, he and I, but he loved my mother, and that's really all I ask of him. We had the necessities of life then, but no luxuries, and college was considered a luxury. No one in my family had ever gone to college, and so they weren't against it. They just thought it was sort of strange. Worse than that, I wanted to go to college in Texas. We didn't have guidance counselors then, so I had to do my own research on English departments. And the two best I could find in the South were at Duke University in North Carolina and at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Texas won out because we had a lot of Navy people in Pensacola who were from Texas. They spoke of it in hushed and reverent tones, with their hands over their hearts. And I thought I ought to take a look at a place like that. That was okay, too. My mother did say, now, there's some things we need to get clear here. One is that you'll have to pay for this yourself, and I knew that. And Baylor was then and still is a very expensive private university, and if I had another hour to talk to you, I'd tell you the series of miracles that enabled me to finish. And then she said, if you go to college in Texas, make up your mind you're going to spend the rest of your life out there because you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant, she said. I told her I was going to do no such thing, but I did, and they don't, and I have, and so what can I tell you? Surely you know that Texas is a state of mind. They've never forgotten that they were a nation, and that's the kind of pride that they feel. I'm jumping ahead a little here. I was a counselor in a little country school where I had kindergarten through 12th grade students. And in the elementary school there, when they finished pledging allegiance to the American flag, these youngsters turned and pledged allegiance to the Texas flag. I know you may think that's a bit much, but I decided that it's okay to love where you live. I hope you love where you live. I love where you live. And people in Texas aren't, just can't even kid about that. I'm sure you know if you've run across any of us. My father-in-law said he brought up his children, telling them, never ask a man where he's from. And you see, if he's from Texas, he'll tell you. And if he's not, it's not nice to embarrass him. I know. Most of this that we do is in fun. Even the bumper sticker that says, on earth as it is in Texas, you know. Until a few years ago, we had both a governor and a lieutenant governor who, by their own admission, were recovering alcoholics. My husband Bob said that made the entire state of Texas eligible for Al-Anon. We were all being influenced and affected by alcoholics. It was inevitable that I marry an alcoholic. Of course it was. If you grow up in an alcoholic home, you will be one or marry one. I have seen oh so few exceptions to that. I got all my feelings of self-worth by rescuing and taking care of. And so, of course, I found someone who would give me an opportunity to do that on a regular basis. Charles and I were college sweethearts. I had managed, remembering how my mother suffered, I had thought that I could avoid it by just not dating anyone who drank. And so I didn't. Now, that isn't too hard at Baylor, which some of you may know is a Baptist convent. Coeducational, but nonetheless. If people drank there, they were sent home. No questions asked, just, you know, the next bus, the next train, and you were out of there. And Charles didn't drink at all when we married. You told me later that it didn't mean he wasn't alcoholic. It meant that it was like tuberculosis. Drinking is only a symptom of alcoholism. And it was as if he had TB and he just hadn't started hemorrhaging yet. Does that make sense? That symptom of his illness had just not yet manifested. But I can tell you that it'll do great things for your guilt to know that he never drank till he married me, you know. And if I didn't think about that, there were people delighted to point it out to me. I know today we had matching neuroses, matching illnesses, and we nourished these neuroses in each other for a very long time. I know today that sick people marry sick people and they rear sick children. And oh, if you don't hear anything else I say, hear that. I was one of those children. I reared two of my own and I worked with thousands of them in the schools. You just cannot come out of an alcoholic home unscathed and unharmed. We were married and lived in Corpus Christi and then San Antonio, the prettiest city in Texas. And then we moved out to West Texas, which has a landscape somewhat like that of the moon. My husband's hometown was Odessa. My mother thought I had gone to the end of the world. She used to call it Odessolate, but not where anyone could hear. I never learned to like the barrenness nor the dust storms, but I loved those people. I have a theory, unsubstantiated as all my theories are, people who live in unforgiving, inhospitable climates have a stamina that we just don't have elsewhere. I notice it when I talk in Wyoming, Montana, the Dakotas, the prairie provinces of Canada. They don't know there's anything they can't do, and so they do it. And I am grateful that that's where we got our sickest, because that's where we found you. I don't know what it's like in West Texas today, but then it was a pocket of enthusiasm, as Clancy says. It was a hotbed of dedicated, warm-hearted, caring programs. I miss them too. I know now that I had some slogans I lived by during the sick years. I wonder if you had any of these. I had these until you gave me better ones. One of them was, what will people think? Did you have that one? What about, don't rock the boat? If he's sober, don't talk about drinking. Did you have this one? It's not that bad yet. Did you ever play Guess What I'm Mad About? Charles used to say that I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. Not true, of course. I did all the wrong things during the years he was drinking, and I kept on doing them. You know, that's If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you always got. That's in our literature. Elegant, don't you think? But it says what it means. I had a cleaning woman then that I have missed also greatly. She was wonderful. And when she was ironing during football season, she would watch football while she ironed. Everyone in Texas loves football. Now, when I say that, everywhere I go, I get these polite nods. You don't understand. It is a religion in Texas. And I have football stories, too. But she would watch, and she would say to me sometimes, because she never caught on to instant replay, she would say, "Maybe this time you'll catch it." After I got to you, I thought, that's what I was like. It had never worked before. But hey, an instant replay of whatever I was doing, maybe this time. And of course, it didn't. It didn't at all. I protected him. I lied for him. I rescued him. I played Let's Pretend as diligently as he drank. He was almost literally loved to death. And that can happen. I was as obsessed with him as he was compelled to drink. So we got to you, both of us, in bad shape. I would like you to think that I stayed with him out of love and loyalty. Now, I shouldn't have to explain Deep South upbringing here, but a lot of you didn't have any Deep South upbringing. I've been listening to your accents for 3 days, and I know that. I grew up on the border of Georgia first and then the border of Alabama. At that time, northern Florida was extremely Deep South. I don't know whether it still is or not. Some of the things we were taught were okay. They just didn't go far enough. We were taught that you don't live with a man and criticize him to other people. I have no argument with that. We had cloth napkins, and when they wore thin, they were patched. But we had cloth napkins. I was taught, keep the men happy and everything else falls into place. No argument with that. Except that I wish someone had added, don't give up big chunks of your own personhood to do that. And no one added that to it. I was a steel magnolia long before the movie and the play. And so my solution was to try harder. And of course, you know how much good that did. I'm sorry to tell you, I won't tell you all my defects. Some of them are so obvious I don't have to, but this one is better. I figured that I had had a very inauspicious beginning. But I had attended an expensive university and paid for it myself. I had married the man I wanted, who was handsome and could be charming and was certainly brilliant. I had the children I wanted when I wanted them. I had a career that I loved and at which I excelled. I didn't understand people who messed up their lives. I mean, I'm sorry, I just didn't. I had no tolerance for nor understanding of people who couldn't cope. I thought they got as good a chance as I did, and I could cope. Now, my history even today is if I express one of these doubts to my sponsor, it gets explained. So when I verbalized that to my first sponsor, she made me repeat on a daily basis for what seems like months, we are not morally superior to sick people. I certainly felt morally superior, and it was drilled into me until I think now I don't even have to remind myself of it. It's almost in my DNA. I did a few things right during those years. I never called Charles a drunk. I never thought of him as a drunk. He was a fine man who drank too much, who had what my Irish grandmother called the failing. I knew at some level that he was sick. That is, I knew he wouldn't be that way because he wanted to be. I didn't know the term sick. I had a God whom I worshipped, not God as I understand him today, but he was my handhold on sanity during those years. And I had a doctor who was my Al-Anon before I got to you, and I say that because he's the one who would say to me, "You have to do something for your own sanity and serenity." What a concept. I was much too busy worrying. And he said, and he knew just which button to push. He said, "Your children need one stable parent." Well, need was the operative word. If you needed me, I was putty in your hands. I still have to watch that today. And he wrote on a prescription pad that I should return to teaching. I had taught before my children were born, and I had been home with them 11 years, and I am so grateful that I was able to do that. That's very hard for young couples today to do. But he wrote, "Return to Teaching." Now, I'm not a spontaneous person. I wish I were. I have worked my way up to flexible, but I'll never be frivolous, you know? I thought about it for a year, and then I did return. I taught English in a very large, very fine, very affluent high school. I used to tell those kids they were a doctor's prescription. I don't think I got one of them by accident, not one. I could talk about that for another hour, too. Anyone who teaches has war stories. I will just tell you that there were those who thought that 150 17-year-olds every day would not constitute therapy. There were those who thought that if you weren't already sick, that would do it. But in that classroom, I was nobody's mother and nobody's wife. And it took the pressure off the wounds so that they could heal a bit. It wasn't one long honeymoon. There were days when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not usually. We knew something was dreadfully wrong, but we didn't suspect alcoholism. I didn't, because Charles was not violent. And he didn't, because his alcoholic uncle was always arrested, you know, and thrown in jail, and he didn't do that. He drank at home, and you don't get arrested when you're doing that. But we knew something was wrong. A business acquaintance of his suggested that he see a counselor in Odessa. This is the only time in this man's life he ever agreed to get any help other than when he got to AA. She was a family therapist, and you have to remember that back then there were not people like this on every street corner. And it was not the end thing to be alcoholic. There were not celebrities shouting from the rooftops, shattering every tradition we have, that they were alcoholic. It was not chic or trendy. It was a terrible stigma attached, and nobody knew that the family was sick too. But he did go to see her after exhausting our ministers and lay counselors and our two local psychiatrists and so forth. And he had been seeing her for 6 weeks. It was January of 1964. Are there moments in your life so lucid, so graced, that you remember every detail? The curtains, the carpet, everything. I remember this phone call like that. The phone rang. I was still home from school for the Christmas holidays. She gave me her name, which I recognized, of course. And she said, "Your husband is an alcoholic. That's a family illness. I need to talk to you, too." And all of my deep south upbringing went out the window, and I said, "You're out of your mind," and hung up. Now, I was brought up that if you don't like somebody, you are kind but cruel. And I can do that very well. You ought to watch me. But I wasn't either of those words in any of their meanings at that point in time. Before I could leave the room, the phone rang again. When I picked it up, before I could say hello, she said, "Don't hang up. I know what you've been through." Well, she couldn't. I hadn't told anybody. There was no way she could have known. But we did go to see her, and she's the one who sent us to you. For 6 months, I went only to open AA meetings. If anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I was kind but cool, and explained to them that I hadn't done any drinking and I didn't need any help. Thank you. I mentioned San Antonio. We lived there 4 years, and our babies were born there, and we went back every chance we got. So for the 4th of July weekend that year, we were in San Antonio. Now, Charles always said, "I must tell you, this was not a slip. It was a carefully planned drunk." But he certainly got rip-roaring drunk. We were at the landing on the San Antonio River listening to jazz, and I thought he was going to drink the Pearl Brewery dry. I know there's no cause and effect here, but when he sobered up, they did indeed go out of business. He said to me as we were driving home, "You know, I'm due to get a six-month chip next week, and I'm going to have to tell my group about this." And in my appalling ignorance, I said, "I won't tell anybody." You have to know how little we knew 35 years ago. We were just the blind leading the blind. We were just groping our way. And he explained to me that that wasn't the name of the game. This got my attention because in the years we had been married, this man had never said, "I was wrong, I'm sorry, I made a mistake." And he was going to go down there and, in essence, say that to some people he had known 6 months, and it made me mad. To begin with, I wanted to be the one to get him sober. Then he would have owed it all to the love of a good woman. And he would have been grateful to me the rest of his life. And you may be sure I would have seen to it that he was. But he did, and I went with him, and this time when someone invited me to Al-Anon, I heard her. I wish I didn't have to tell you why, but rigorous honesty. Someone I considered as good as I was asked me, "Hey, it takes what it takes. God uses the people he needs." This woman had everything I considered important. She had beauty and breeding and brains and education and status and money, and she still has everything I consider important, but it's a different list today. She became my first sponsor. I've had 3 sponsors in 35 years and have learned enormously from each of them. That's another talk, too. I cannot tell you how strongly I believe in sponsorship. Now, I know that I come from a mentoring background, okay? I'm a good teacher and I'm a good student. So I just took to it like a duck to water. But whether you do or not, I haven't seen anyone yet recover without it. There may be those. They just haven't told me about it. I had been praying for help, but I thought God showing very poor taste. You know, this wasn't what I had in mind. I have to tell you here that I had married considerably above myself. Charles used to say, "Don't say that. I don't know any other way to say it." I had married into a fine old family that had money and prestige, and there was nobody not allowed to play with me anymore. Can you think what that meant to me? And I was afraid if I went down there to that building with those people, I would lose all of that. But I began to hear the program, and not all at once, and not just for one person, of course. I've told you it wasn't trendy back then. There were not treatment centers on every corner. There were not TV announcements every 30 minutes. Years later, when I was working as a counselor in this country school, I was been visiting with a first grader. I was taking him back to his room, and he said, "My teacher's not here today." I said, "Yeah, I noticed." He's bouncing along, you know. He said, "She's sick." I said, "Yes." He said, "They sent another teacher." I said, "Sure did." He said, "When I'm sick, they don't send another little boy." I looked at that precious little face and I thought, "Oh, honey, the times you'll wish you could send someone else to do it for you, you know." Well, they didn't send another sick candidate for Al-Anon to recover for me either. My group said that we don't hear the answer until we've asked the question. Now, if you know everything, you don't ask any questions. My sponsor pointed that out to me. I couldn't think why. She said, if you have all the answers, you aren't seeking any others. And my husband's sponsor, who was a beautiful red-haired woman, from whom I learned as much as I did my own in those early years, who never spoke to me other than lovingly but this once, and maybe this was lovingly too, she said, "Blanche, I know you think you're a hell of a lot smarter than the people in that Al-Anon room, but they're happy and you're not. Why don't you go find out why?" So I have spent 35 years finding out why. My sponsor said, "God can only fill an empty vessel." She said, "You can't put new wine in old bottles." And she suggested that I had a whole lot to unlearn before I could hear them. I'll mention only a few of these things because, you know, I bet you were taught these things too by well-meaning people who didn't know they were teaching you lies, falsehoods. First one is, God helps those who help themselves. Did you get that one? He does not, you know. God helps those who ask. And the times I've needed him most desperately, I could not have helped myself if my life had depended on it, and it very nearly did. God helps those who ask. And then I was taught, and oh, I learned this one well. Mature people don't ask for help. They stand on their own 2 feet. Did you get that one? Solve their own problems. And you taught me that babies are dependent. They'll die if we don't take care of them. Adolescents are independent. I'll do it myself. And this is a facet of their growth they must go through. But mature, healthy adults are very happily interdependent. I am not talking about a sick, clinging neediness, okay? I am talking about that in my life, God works through other people and has certainly sent me the people I need when I need them. And I have learned to ask for help. If you could see my long distance charges, you'd know how well I've learned to. If I can't make it through the night in Texas, California's still awake, you know. And even if California's asleep, I have friends in Hawaii. You told me that I had not only a right to, but a responsibility for taking care of myself emotionally. When you said take care of yourself, I thought you meant eat right and get exercise. I didn't know that some pain can be avoided. I didn't know that I didn't have to die on every cross, you know? And I know that today. And I happily ask for help. I was taught, and I'll bet you were, that we put everyone else first. And when my sponsor began protesting about that, I said, "You're not talking about me first." She said, "Oh no, I'm talking about my turn." And today I'm able to say, "I believe it's my turn," or words to that effect, when that is necessary. My second sponsor taught me this, and it has saved my life and my sanity. She said, "Anytime I'm facing a difficult, challenging situation, there are two questions that I must ask myself. The first is, what is in my best interest?" Well, now you can't be a martyr and do that. And I had suffered, you know, so nobly all those years. I have a friend who says it required plastic surgery to get her hand off her forehead when she got into the program. But I know today to think, if I don't say it, what is in my best interest here? And I've given up martyrdom. That's no fun at all. And then she said, "You don't have to like any situation, but it is imperative that you like yourself in it." And so she said, "Ask yourself, what will enable me to like myself later?" That got me through a very painful divorce in 1980. It's still the hardest thing I have ever done. I would not change one word I said or one thing I did during that divorce. Do you know how good that feels? Oh, I do recommend that you think, what will enable me to like myself later? I was taught what you don't know can't hurt you. What I didn't know could have killed four people. And so, item by item, I unlearned a great many things so that I could hear you. And I got very greedy for this program. I didn't want to settle for a spiritual band-aid. I didn't want to settle for crumbs when I knew there was a banquet spread. We have an AA in Houston who says, she tells about a little boy who kept falling out of bed at night. Parents took him to a counselor, and the counselor said, "Why do you think you keep falling out of bed?" And he says, "Well, I go to sleep too close to where I got in." I don't want to do that in this program. I didn't want to go to sleep too close to where I came in, because it would be too easy to fall out. So I began to learn some spiritual laws from you that transcend all the man-made laws that I had kept so diligently all my life. The worst immorality is judgment, and it is my most glaring defect. Either God hasn't seen fit to remove it, or I haven't been willing. Which do you think? I just think people ought to shape up, you know? Some of you do too, all right. The only thing that has enabled me to be a little less so is that any time I find myself judging people, God gives me their situation to handle. Now think about that a minute. Any time I say, "Well, you'd never catch me," you will. And sooner rather than later. And any time I say, "Well, I would never," I do. And at least today, I hear myself. I wish I could tell you I never say it, but at least today, I hear myself. You know, when we invite God into our lives in step three, I think most of us expect that He will make it beautiful. He will tidy things up, you know, put a few flowers here and there. And what happens is that one morning you look out the window and a wrecking ball is headed straight at you. And God is saying, "We better start all over again here. Your foundation is shot." At least I think that's what happened with me. You told me, of course, to release this man. You said, "Release him with love." Actually, my group said, "If you don't like the warts, let go of the frog." That's what they said. I didn't like the warts. I didn't like the person I had become. I'm not basically a bitch nor a shrew, and I was both of those in spades. I don't do this well today, but I'm better than I was. Sometimes I still have to withdraw emotionally a little before I can release. And sometimes I release with anger before I can with love.
And everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it, but I'm better at it than I used to be. I learned to quit translating. Did you ever do that? Honey, what your daddy meant was... I wish I had time to talk to you about kids in the program. I would tell anyone who would listen how much Charles had damaged our children. And my group made me look at how much I had damaged them. And I thought I couldn't stand it. I would have died for them in a New York minute as you would your child. Let me mention just two here. I had a choice during those drinking years. I could go or stay. Those kids had no choice. And first of all, when they turned to this woman to whom they should have been able to turn for the truth under any circumstances, I said things like, "Why, no, honey, that, you must have had a bad dream. That didn't happen last night." Or, "Why do you think something's wrong? Why, no, there's nothing wrong." Now, I submit to you that kids brought up being told those things grow up doubting their senses, doubting their judgment. They knew very well what they had seen and heard. And I damaged them because the first 10 years of their lives they were programmed by an enraged mother who yelled and screamed and threw things. I would change that if I could. Oh, I would. But here again, I was taught that I would not recover unless I learned not just to accept this woman I used to be, but to love her. She did the best she could at her level of enlightenment. I was more than my mistakes even then, and so were you. And so I have forgiven her. It took me longer than it did God, but my children were in Alateen for 10 years each, and here again, if there was time, I have stories I could tell you about having the whole family in recovery. Someone was mentioning not working on our defects, but surrendering them. That's what my son used to say to me. I cried a lot when I got to you. You had given me permission. I hadn't cried in years, and I cry anytime I please now. Charles used to say I could cry reading telephone directories or menus. No, supermarket openings are rather touching, don't you think? I cry at television commercials, the Hallmark ones, you know. And at the Olympic Games, when he wins the gold medal and they play his national anthem, whatever it is, well, I am just a basket case. But I was crying, standing at the sink, it's less messy that way. And my son would come in, and he was, I don't know, 14, 15 then, run his finger down my back and say, "Hey, why don't you third step it and keep walking?" We developed our own vocabulary. It was wonderful. There will be a special place in heaven. Now, when I'm in California, I say an especially beneficial karma for Alateen sponsors. God bless you, bless you, bless you. You do help undo some of the god-awful damage we do our kids. Next to an alcoholic, anyone looks good. And I wasn't accustomed to people suggesting, one, there was anything wrong with me, or two, I needed help. And when I grudgingly accepted that just, you know, maybe, a little tweaking here and there, I realized I had lost my whipping boy. No matter how you behave, if you're married to an alcoholic, people forgive you. I mean, after all, if you could see her husband. And I had lost my scapegoat. And I was relieved when you said I was not responsible for his behavior. He always said I was, and of course I believed him. But you told me I was entirely responsible for my own behavior, and I didn't want to hear that. It had been so handy to blame it all on how I suffer, you know, if you knew how I live. And so I think I got my responsibilities straight. I was not responsible for him nor his disease, but for myself. You told me that I could respond rather than react. No matter what anybody else did, you said, I could choose my reaction. That's a real freedom. 99 times out of 100, I can do that today. Once in a while, I don't, but most of the time, I do. I hadn't realized that I was in such emotional slavery. But you know, it was as if I waked up every morning and said to Charles, "Good morning, how do I feel today?" Because it was up to him. Now, let me say quickly, he didn't ask for that. I handed my self-worth to him on a platter and said, "What I think of me will depend on you." What a terrible thing to do to another person. We're taught never to say never and never to say always. I hope I never do that again. I haven't so far. In the relationships I have had, Neither of us had a loose umbilical cord that we were trying to plug into the other for a life support system. The people with whom I have spent time since then, we are together because we want to be. And there's a huge difference in that. My group said, you don't have to be in emotional slavery. Take your sails out of his wind. And neither he nor anyone else need decide the direction in which you go. And sure enough, I did, and it works. I'm just telling you the things that helped me to get well. I learned that it was no one's assignment on earth to make me happy, that I didn't acquire squatter's rights on someone's life because I married it or gave birth to it. That's a gift I gave my family in recovery. Now, I didn't learn all this at once. I don't have it all yet. I learned slowly, painfully, you know, 124 hours at a time. And there were days, there still are, when I think, what program? God, who? And I call one of you, and you will tell me what program in God, who? I count on you for that. You told me I didn't have to be perfect. You said practice makes progress. You said recovery is progressive, too. And that's true. The weller we get, the weller we can get. English teachers are allowed to make up their own words. It's in our contract. I have relapses, and I have been asked at least four times by people here to be sure to tell this. I've told it for so many years, I think, you know, I might leave it off now, but I like to tell it. I was in Dallas visiting my son, 1984, I guess. He lived in a condo with a very long flight of cement, concrete, I don't know the difference, stairs, going down to the driveway. And I have had three kinds of arthritis, one since childhood. My knees are not reliable, and one of them buckled, and I fell down the stairs. It was a very bad fall. I was unconscious. He called paramedics, who took me to an emergency room. I don't remember any of that. But I came to as the emergency room nurse was saying, now, just lay back and take deep breaths. Coming out of total oblivion, I said, honey, that's lie back. I will lie back and take deep breaths. Let my defenses get down, and I'm going to straighten people out. I think they ought to shape up. I passed out again, but when I came to, I could not shut up. I said, you say that so many times every day. You really need to say it correctly. My son was putting his hands over his eyes. He was saying, she doesn't do this to total strangers usually. Really, she doesn't. Fortunately, the nurse thought it was funny. She said, you sound just like my husband. And I thought, well, good for him. Why don't you listen? But I didn't say that. So, of course, I have relapses. They just don't put me in jail or the hospital. Well, I was in the hospital that time, but it wasn't because of that. Of course, I talk the talk better than I walk the walk. Of course I do. But I live on the growing edge, just as any brand new person does. And I need a hand to hold while I look around corners. And I never reached out that a hand of yours hasn't been there. Al-Anon family groups means that we talk about family. My children are convinced that I tell their innermost secrets to about 20,000 people a year. I try so hard not to. I just give you the bare facts and tell you my reaction, usually. Both my children have been married and divorced. They have not had to do any drinking or drugging. I have reared two quintessential caretakers. I don't know which disease is worse. They are classic enablers. My son used to bring home hitchhikers when he was a teenager, and they stayed anywhere from overnight to a week. You know, I don't know why we weren't murdered in our beds, but he felt sorry for them and thought he should take care of them. Now, where did he see a role model like that? I think they're fine today, thank you. And if they are, I mean literally, thank you. My son is a commercial photographer in Dallas. Of course, I think he does brilliant and sensitive work. He's won award after award. He's won two Clios. He's won awards I don't remember the names of. And do you know, he was the first person working for himself, not with an advertising agency, to win that Clio the first time. They had the awards ceremony in New York, you know, with the little gold statue and everything. And the trade papers and the Dallas papers made a big thing of it. They never once put a comma after his name and said, the son of. Well, I know where his talent comes from. I know what the source is, you know? And what I did was get out of his way and let him use his bathroom, which he shared with his sister, for a dark room which did not charm her at all. today she's glad, of course, that he did that. We date the people we meet, and he meets models. And there was a long time when planes, you had more time when you laid over. Do you know what I'm talking about? I have to just run to catch planes today. But when I had a few hours in Dallas, he would bring one of these charming young women out to the airport and sit with me while I waited. They all weighed 36 pounds and had legs up to their armpits. I told him if I wanted to feel dowdy, I could stay home and iron, you know. This was my loving child. This is the one who would send me flowers on his birthday and say thank you for having me. Who would write to me on the anniversary of my mother's death and say, I think of my mother on this day too. And in 1988, he wrote me and said he didn't want to be in the family anymore. Now, if he drank, if he did drugs, I'd know where he could get help. He doesn't blame it on anyone, nor should he. He just has severe incapacitating depression. And you know, if you have impaired judgment, by virtue of having it, you don't know you have it. Did you follow that? Okay. I thought it would kill me. You don't die from pain like that. What you do is get it to a live-withable level. But there isn't a day that I don't grieve for this lost child. I had two notes from him last year, none this year. Everywhere I talk, I say, if you run out of things to pray about, would you pray about this young man's reconciliation with his family? For 20 years, my daughter was a journalist. She was very good, too. We're achievers. Hey, what can I tell you? That's what got me at the very beginning, attention and praise, and I guess that's what earned it for my kids, too. She, too, has won awards and was political editor for the St. Petersburg Times for 10 years, and then they sent her to Washington to be their national correspondent. I loved hearing her tell about the famous people she had met, and, you know, I got a vicarious pleasure out of her flying all over the world and being in all these exciting events. 2 years ago, she called me and told me she had resigned her job, that she had applied for and been accepted to the Unity Ministerial School in Lee's Summit, Missouri. Not yet to where I can clap, but I... It took every meeting I have ever attended to be able to say, how exciting. What an adventure, thinking you've done what? She gave up an astronomical salary. Well, anyway, I, of course, said all the right things. I've supported her all her life. I wasn't going to stop then. I don't have to understand it, you know, to love and support her. But when we finished talking, I called my sponsor. Babbling, blubbering, crying. Let me tell you what. When I finally stopped for breath, she said, who reared that kid? She said, who brought up a kid that would find a God of her understanding and want to help other people? I can't imagine anybody doing that. I said, but she's giving up so much. And she said, and for what? For God. Can you believe it? She said, now, I have you to thank for this because in Alateen, that subversive organization, Alateen, they taught her she could be who she is. And in Al-Anon, they taught me I must let her be. I attended her ordination last month, and she is associate pastor of the Unity Church in Dallas, which has 1,200 members and should keep her off the streets and out of trouble, don't you think? I've got to hurry. Charles and I lost our marriage for a variety of reasons that it would be inappropriate for me to discuss at a microphone. I will just tell you that there were disorders other than alcoholism, and he chose not to have those treated. You had said to me, marriage is made in sickness, do not always survive health. And I didn't want to believe you, but believe it. They do not always. People who love us want to know, so I'll tell you, he did not leave me for another woman, no. I did not throw him out for another man, and he had not resumed drinking. He would have had 24 years continuous sobriety in July of 1988, but he died in April of that year. Lung cancer, oat cell carcinoma, still smoking 4 packs a day. I was astonished at the level and the intensity of my grief. We had been divorced for 8 years, and the pain was just as if I had been living with him every day of that. Recovery had taken us, you know, down different roads and in different directions, and something toxic happened when we related to each other that didn't happen when we related to other people. It had become a destructive relationship. We could not get any further recovery in the framework of a marriage that was sick beyond healing, that had been damaged beyond repair. Please hear this. It was not a lack of love. If you've lived this long and you haven't learned that love is not always enough, you haven't been paying attention. It is not always enough. Nobody wants divorce. It's not in anyone's game plan. But I never felt more direct guidance. I never felt more helpfully Al-Anon than when I realized that I, too, would go to any lengths for recovery. After a long marriage ends in divorce, it's like an amputation. It may be necessary for survival, but the agony is intense, and there's phantom pain where the relationship used to be. I'll always regret the necessity for it. Not the divorce, no regrets for that, but that it had to happen, as I would regret the necessity for an amputation. You told me suffering should not be wasted, that I don't back God into a corner, shake my finger in his face, and say, why me? After all, why not me, huh? But that I should say to him, what am I supposed to understand? And so I did that. I still do it, not on a daily basis anymore. The answers aren't all in, but I began to understand very quickly after that divorce that God and I are enough. And everything else is icing on the cake, and there's a lot of icing. That I don't have to know what the future holds because I know who holds the future. And for a woman of my generation, this is a biggie. I'm a whole person without a man. And that certainly frees up the men in my life because I'm not looking to them, as I said earlier, for a life support system. If you love teaching, you do a great deal of counseling, and I thought I ought to get a piece of paper that said I could. So I began to investigate graduate schools. And I chose the longest, hardest one, of course. You told me I deserved the best, so that's what I picked. It was the University of Texas in Austin. It was 3 years, 54 hours, and a thesis. I said to my children, do you know how old I'll be in 3 years if I go get a master's degree? And my son said, how old will you be in 3 years if you don't? See, no one had explained it to me like that. I pulled up roots, I left my comfort zone, I sold the house my children had grown up in, and you would have laughed to see me in graduate school. I kept wanting to teach the class. I wanted to say, honey, what the professor meant was, I also wanted to correct their grammar, but I don't do that if I'm conscious. I did get the degree in counseling psychology in 1985. I worked as a counselor at Austin Community College part-time, but the rent was coming due with great regularity and I was self-supporting through my own contributions, and so that's when I took a full-time job and I was counselor in the little country school that I mentioned. I stayed at the college to teach one class a week. It had to be taught by a counselor. It was a class in human sexuality. Interesting being interviewed for it. How do you ascertain that someone is qualified to teach a sex class? You can't claim to have majored in it in college, although you and I know people who tried, don't we? Finally, this group that was interviewing me asked, I thought, a very intelligent question. They said, how did you learn about sex in your family of origin? And I told them the truth. I said, I had an aunt who is the matriarch of our family. And she used to say to my mother, when it's time to tell Blanche Marie the facts of life, let me do it. You'll make it sound entirely too exciting. But my mother told me thank you. It was fun to teach this class. Unlike the kids in my English classes, these kids never once said, what are we learning this for? We'll never use this. Never once. Change is hard for me. I'm sure it's not for any of you, but it's hard for me, and I'm going to tell you about a few changes I've made, and then I'm through. One thing was hard to teach, to switch from teaching to counseling. They're not the same thing. My first week in this little country school, a mother called me and said her first grade boy was having trouble on the school bus. Would I see? He wouldn't talk about it at home. Would I see if he'd talk to me? So I brought him in. Beautiful little boy. I said, tell me what happens on the bus. Well, he said, those kids pester me. I said, what do you do? Well, he said, I don't use dirty words. I said, well, I'm so glad. What do you do? He reached over and got my tablet. Now, tongue between the teeth, he printed very laboriously, H-S-I-T. He said, I wrote that down. I said, then what? Well, I showed it to them. I said, yes. And he said, well, they couldn't read it. Now, I was a fire horse hearing the bell. You don't wave a misspelled word in front of an English teacher. And I said, well, honey, you didn't spell it right. No wonder they couldn't read it. Look, this is how you spell it. I was crossing the T before I thought, oops. I don't think this is why they hired me. Nowhere in my job specifications did it say teach obscenities to six-year-olds. I've always hoped when he went home that day, no one said, what did you learn in school today? But if he's needed that word since, he knows how to spell it. But I made some more successful changes. I didn't know I would be happy living alone, and I was. I was so surprised. I was alone for 11 years. I have to say this carefully. I am not young, and I have never been beautiful. But I like men a great deal, and there were friendships and relationships during that time that I wouldn't have missed for anything. And for the last few years of those 11 years, I was hanging out with Bob Miller, and about once a year someone would talk about getting married, and whoever brought it up depended on the other one to say, oh, things are fine the way they are. And so it was November 91. I was getting ready to go talk in Tulsa. He lived in Temple, which is a town of some, 60,000, 70,000, south of Waco, north of Austin. And I lived in Austin. So we talked on the phone every night. And I have to tell you that every now and then I step outside my program for just a minute and do a little managing and controlling. I mean, hey, somebody's got to, and I do it so well. So I said, now, your 25th AA birthday is in 5 weeks. What would you like to do? We ought to do something special. And he said, I was thinking I might like to get married. Well, now, it wasn't even his turn in the first place. And then he said, I've talked to my three children, my attorney, my AA sponsor, and my accountant, and they all think it's a good idea. Is that romantic or what? Could you have turned down a proposal like that? I said, well, let me talk to some people, too. And I came back from Oklahoma on Monday and said, let's do it. If I had been 20 years old, you'd have sworn I was pregnant. That was the most hurried-up wedding you ever saw in your life. He was an ardent Episcopalian. I grew up Southern Baptist. And let me say about Baptists what has been said about Catholics here. I never heard anything about a God of hellfire and damnation. Always I heard God loves you, God guides you, God protects you. But I wasn't in a church at this time, and he was, and so we were interviewed, of course, before the wedding. And the Episcopalian minister said, among other things, that Bob would have to write a letter and get permission from his bishop. My ex-husband was dead, but his ex-wife was still alive. And I said, because it was a little neighborhood church, I said, how many people does your church seat? And he said, 122 Episcopalians or 140 Baptists. I walked right into it. I said, why more Baptists? And he said, they're narrower. There were those rude enough to suggest that we have the organist play Amazing Grace out of deference to our age when we walked down the aisle. But we didn't. We were married December 7th, 1991. We bought a house in this little village, Salado, which is quaint and colorful and historic. It's sort of like the Texas version of Brigadoon, and I love it. And that was in February. Bob became ill in March, and in June we were told he would not recover. And I grabbed onto you, and I held on by my fingernails. And you supported me like bookends for the next year and a half. I've talked about this now for 5.5 years. Just give me a minute. This man who had taught me so much about living taught me so much about dying. He died of hepatitis B, and the pain was intense, and I never heard him complain once. He often said to me, "I would rather be in my position than yours." He said, "I would rather be dying than watching you die." And I assured him it was painful. Yes, you know, it was. His AA group in Temple brought him a meeting every week until he was too ill to know what was going on. And he died in December of 1993. I wish you could have been at the memorial service at the funeral. There was the bank president and the tattooed bikers, you know. You know, the motley crew of people that come to our major events in our lives. There was the Rotary Club president and the kids that worked for Bob. One of the most comforting things I received from the love of so many people was from an Al-Anon friend in Colorado. Some of you know Rusty Kelly. And she called me and said, "God did not take your husband, he received him." I give you that because you might find some comfort from that sometime. I have felt since his death sort of unsettled. I've been told all my life that when God closes one door, he opens another, but I'm here to tell you it is hell in the hallway. And I asked my group one meeting to talk about that. What do you do when you're in the hallway, waiting for the door to open? Interesting answers. One of them said, "Well, I just sort of homestead." She said, "I get so comfortable that when the door opens, I resent the draft." And one said, "Well, I tried to break the locks." And she said, "Of course, I know it would be like tearing open the bud of a flower. You don't get a flower, you get a torn up bud." But she said, "That's what I try to do." Another said, "I sometimes get stuck in a half-closed door. And if I can't give up what is past, then I'm not allowed to see what I'm supposed to do next." Some said, "The door opens and I don't like what I see, and I won't go through that door." And so I imagine I'm not the only one in this room who feels as if she's in the hallway. But I'll be all right because you told me that. Thank you for loving me back. I'm going to close with something from our literature, which may be why you don't know. Don't say that, Blanche. It's in our literature. It says, "Today, this very moment is all you're sure of. And that flashing instant has gone to join the past even before you're aware of it. With this dizzy spin of time, the only safe way to make each moment count is to make Al-Anon responses habitual. You can't go wrong following Al-Anon's teachings. With these teachings, there is no regret for yesterday. There's guidance for today, and there's hope for tomorrow." So that's the promise with which I leave you on this warm July afternoon in Daytona Beach, Florida. We are promised no regret for yesterday, guidance for today, and best of all, hope for tomorrow.